Hey everybody, it's Zach. A quick note before the episode begins. This week I did not have my podcast microphone. I left it in Florida while traveling last week. This weekend I will recover it and my audio will be back up to par next week. So hope that's okay.
Let's talk about some iOS updates to start out with this week. We've got iOS 13.7 and iOS 14 beta 7. So starting out with iOS 13.7, what is new in this really high version number that we're seeing in September?
Yeah, the whole COVID thing has kind of shot the version numbers up this year. Like for a while, everyone was talking about the bugginess of iOS 13. That was obviously the big 2019 story, and how Apple was pumping out updates, having like the 0.1 a week after they did 0.0, but then the numbers have now shot up to 0.7, which I believe is a record for like the minor number. I think the previous we got to was 0.5, but two of those updates are just adding like the exposure notification stuff, right? So you can, a couple of the earlier updates were representative of just fixing bugs, but a lot of if it wasn't for the pandemic, we wouldn't have crossed and made a record minor number, if you see what I mean. So because I see some people like, look how high how many versions of iOS 13 people have to put out because it was so bad.
Whose voice is that?
That is my generic Twitter complainer voice.
Is that how you read Twitter?
Yeah. the more intelligent comments get a different voice, but that is
okay. That is, so they're in your voice.
The crowd think. But what is coming 13.7 is the deployment of the promised phase 2 thing, and Apple is branding this as Exposure Notification Express. And basically it's building the ability to get COVID proximity alerts directly into the setup process of the phone, so you don't need to download a third-party app. You can just update your iPhone and it will ask you on setup, do you want to enable COVID notification exposure notifications. Unfortunately, it doesn't just work. Apple still has to partner with like the local health authorities, but they've actually made it simpler for the local health authorities to get on board. So like a state doesn't have to make an app if they don't want to. Apple says they're going to continue to support the people who have gone out of the way to make the whole app, and obviously then you can get some additional functionality by opening the app itself. But baseline notifications now can be done just through this like express version,
and this is what they called phase two when they were
right
back in March and April when they had, I guess it was mostly April, when they had their two-phase plan between Apple and Google to develop the API for contact tracing, that the fastest way to do it is support the API in Android and iOS, and then given more time, they could develop this feature. And I imagine there's also a corresponding Android update.
Yes.
To 13.7. Is that correct, available as well?
Yes, it goes through Google Play Services, but that is out as well. Right. Yeah. Because cool. I think when they were planning this back in March time, they were probably optimistically looking for higher adoption because they were like, we're going to do the phase one first to get it out there so everyone can adopt the API, and then we'll do ours down the road. But
I briefly remember them saying something about at least in each region greater than 50% adoption for it to be effective.
For it to be effective, right. And yeah. They certainly haven't got 50% of regions even offering it at the moment. The phase two has arrived, and they've got a smattering of countries and a few states on board with the previous model. So hopefully the express version will actually speed that process up.
They did a press release that was really if you didn't follow this stuff, then you think it was pretty positive. I think from our perspective, that the lack of support from different states and countries is concerning, considering that the technology companies made this stuff. But if you read that press release, then you'd think they're doing pretty good. And it's just kind of that's their job as PR, I guess, is to put that spin on it. All right. But, it was really one of those press releases that made me think, oh, man, this is not quite the reality, even if the numbers are true. It was a lot of interest and stuff like that. But if you look at it and say, well, really, there's a handful of states out of 50 that are participating, it's not there yet.
Yeah. So on the old framework version, obviously, a local health government would have to hire a massive team of developers and server engineers, and they'd have to work together to make the application, not just for iOS, but also for Android, obviously. That's all been streamlined now with the Express version. Basically, the governments only have to write a config file that says like their name and the logo and then what criteria applies to trigger notification, because in different states or different countries, the local health guidance varies a bit. So what should trigger an exposure notification alert is different in different places. So, you know, Apple and Google are trying to be pretty flexible and saying, look, we can detect these, you know, 10 different criteria. Tell us which ones apply to your area, and then we can send out the notifications in that way. And then in that config file, they can also just write like the message they want to show when an exposure alert is detected. So it should, it means they don't have to hire like, you know, 10 developers to make an app, which is part of the reason it's taken so long for these places. For the states that want to do it, it's just taken months because, you know, it requires engineering work and testing and et cetera. So this is much closer to the metal and much easier for them to get on board. It's like filling out a form on a website versus like building the website, if that makes sense.
So does this mean that tracking state apps is less valuable, or, you know, is it, there's still a state by state, I guess, adoption to be tracked, whether it's phase one or phase two, whether it's having a dedicated app or supporting the OS feature?
Yeah, I think it's basically the same. Like the you're still going to need the app to report yourself as COVID-19 positive. So that's the difference.
And that's unchanged since the beginning.
Correct.
That was the plan.
Yeah, but at least for notification delivery, that can be done on a phase two approach, which is probably better because then you don't have to worry about going to the app store or anything. You'll just get presented, like users literally just get asked when they update to 13.7, do you want to enable COVID-19 notifications if it's supported for your region?
Yeah.
And you can get a push notification when the region comes on board. So if you update and it's not supported, like in the UK at the moment, although they're hoping to still supposedly roll one out by the end of the year, you can get a notification for when it is there so you can turn it on. So you can be prompted to enable it.
Yeah. And this was released just on September the 1st. So this is brand new this week. So
because it was in beta. It went to beta last week, right? And when it first came out, people were like, you know, I assumed and stuff that, oh, this is because iOS 14 is going to be late, and so they're having to roll it into the like a 13.7 version rather than 14.0. But they clearly had no interest in waiting around because it got released within a week. So that explains why, you know, like Mark Gurman and others have been saying that, oh, no, don't worry, iOS 14 is still coming in September, and it's just going to launch way earlier than the phones will because the phones are coming like mid-October and they're launched with like 14.1. But apparently iOS 14.0 is coming out sometime in September, so that'll be interesting because it's going to be before the iPhone event, whereas normally Apple announces the release date for the major operating system alongside the announcement of the phones, right?
Yeah, I was looking for when they did the I guess there was kind of an announcement about this. They did share some numbers about like kind of how the experience has gone so far. There's like a greater than zero number of people who have benefited possibly from. from you know what's been out there. I can't find it in front of me there right now, but that's something I was curious about. Was, you know, I wonder if anyone actually has benefited from what they've been able to deploy so far. It was just because of the you know, hesitation from states and the roadblocks to put this out there. But,
yeah, I think they said that 25 states and territories in the U.S. Are exploring exposure notification systems, which represents more than half of the population. But exploring versus committed and doing it is very different things.
As we've seen so far, yes.
Correct.
And then in iOS 14 beta 7, that's out today. There's also watchOS 7 beta 7 from yesterday and macOS Big Sur beta 6 from today. The big thing that I've seen so far is new wallpapers, sort of. The six color, like Apple color rainbow wallpapers in iOS 14, they now have a dark mode version where there's always been a black background version with six color stripes across. Plus, there were versions with colors as the background. And now, they all do this now that if you're in dark mode, then they all go black.
Yeah, so the light mode version now is like a color flash.
It's the old version.
Yeah, and now the background goes true black and you just get the stripes going across the middle. So for a while Apple had like the still wallpapers, like the stock ones, which did have the the different versions for light and dark mode, but then below you just have the general wallpapers. And so it's someone decided, you know what, we can do a dark mode version of the stripes as well. So now you've got black version, you've got black background version of the like five color stripes or the six color stripes. The earth and flower wallpapers continue, are just unchanged below, so they're still just like straight photographs if you don't want something that changes.
Yeah, so they're more dynamic than ever, at least.
And the actual dynamic wallpapers continue to have no changes whatsoever.
Yeah. And then macOS Big Sur Beta 6, so I was happy to see that out because I love macOS Big Sur and I can't wait for it to be stable, and it's not there yet. At least in my configuration, with having a laptop that I put into clamshell mode, you know, close a lid, connected to a mouse and keyboard, and a couple of displays, and I still have that experience where it's like a time bomb of when it's going to reboot if I do that. And so, luckily, everything's pretty good, like autosave these days. I was even in GarageBand doing some audio stuff, and I was like, oh no, I lost all that work, but it autosaved. But it's at the point now, like, we're getting closer. I guess macOS updates tend to be, like, later anyway.
Yeah, they don't have to be day and date.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm hoping that at least beta version gets more stable. Otherwise, right now I'm considering that my 16-inch MacBook Pro is, like, the whatever version we're on that's not Big Sur. Was it Catalina?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, that's the version that I keep this on for a while.
So. Yeah, it's still beta season, right? We've got to see how it
plays out. Yeah, still beta season.
When they finally get to GM. The one other thing I want to mention from iOS 14 beta 7 is the app library seeing a few changes. So they have... Really? Yeah, so you know, like before, the categorization was really weird because it was basically just ripping the App Store categories. And now they've changed the categorization a bit. Obviously, this beta has only just come out, so having a full chance to like analyze if it's actually different or just the names are different. But it seems slightly more sane because like before... They've got a few new groupings now, like information and reading, and then productivity and finance. Like they have a bit more grouping than just like what the App Store categories are. So it seems like they've made it a bit more intelligent. I'll be honest, I haven't used the app library since beta 1, just because I never saw a need for it really in how I use the phone. So I can't remember exactly what was different from before. But the way I look at it now, and the labels are definitely different. So, and it did seem to make a little bit more sense to me when I was just looking at the categories that are there on my phone.
Yeah, I mean, my homepage is the same as, like, I guess the first week I started using iOS 14, which is that I got my home screen, you know, with two widgets and eight icons in the dock, and then app library. So social utilities, productivity and finance, creativity, entertainment, travel, information and reading. I think that might have been truncated before. Now it's, like, small text, so it's not truncated anymore.
Right, okay.
It's a sign of good progress. Shopping and food, health and fitness. Which my dog tracker is still there, and other test flight and education. I wonder why education is at the very bottom of all those things.
Yeah, that's the problem with this thing. Like, if you just want something slightly different, you can't change it. Like,
maybe you can. Is it like by use?
I don't know. Like, my social app's always near the top, and mine's always too. Like social utilities then games. So, like, and I don't play a lot. I don't play a lot of games. Play like one or two, maybe. I have Fortnite downloaded at the moment just to track the continuing progress of the big debacle. But so that's the my problem with the app library is that it's there for people that don't want to organize their apps, but you kind of need, I find I need at least a little bit of organization so I can put something where I want. I don't want stuff to fly around. And then what if the suggestions change and for some reason, you know, this app needs to be here? Like, I feel like the old approach of just having, you know, your first page home screen of icons and then like a second page just full of folders where the folders are arranged to your liking, that suits a lot of people better, including me. And then, I mean, the app library will get used because there's plenty of people in the world who have no time to organize the home screen at all, so they'll just have
it. I think it's so good. I forgot if I told you, probably privately, not on the show, but my 7-year-old daughter, Emily, she saw my phone and she said, I want my phone to look like that, because what she saw was not like widgets or anything. It was app library, and she wanted the big folders. It's like, okay, iOS 14 is pretty good now. I'll put it on your phone.
It'd be interesting to see how many people like adopt it and use it versus people who like think they've deleted an app but actually it's just gone to the app library and they never find it again. Like, and they just don't realize that it's still on their phone. Like, it will take some training for people to understand the metaphors.
Yeah. So the first thing I did was the update, and then I like hid her second and third home screens, and she was happy. So. pretty cool. And then I started the widgets, and she was really happy about that. And the animations for like adding a widget is so nice. It's like really a throwback to
Dashboard
using Max. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the animations on App Library and the widget stuff are really well done. Like they definitely polished them up.
Yeah, someone who appreciates charming animations made those. And then this mandatory permissions dialogue for tracking. This is something about advertising. Facebook was very mad about it. Today, the information had an exclusive report saying that Apple was communicating to developers that they were going to delay this requirement in iOS 14. It's still there, but it won't be enforced until next year sometime. And then after the original exclusive report from the information, there was an embargo time at 1 p.m. Eastern time where certain members of the press were informed about this, and then Apple published a post about it as well. What does all of this mean?
Yeah, so this all relates to what's called the IDFA identifier, and it's basically the last stand that advertising frameworks or tracking frameworks have been able to use to identify a user between apps. So over time, Apple's slowly being removed the different ways that a user on one app can be re-identified if you download a separate application. And as of iOS 14, Apple's now cracked down even harder by they were going to require like a pop-up dialogue which said, do you want to let this app track you, yet deny or allow? And if you pressed allow, the app would get your IDFA number. And if you said deny, then the app would just get garbage, so it couldn't track you around. So in iOS 13, the IDFA is freely available unless you go into like settings and then like limit ad tracking. If you turn that on, it basically blanks out the IDFA with just like all zeros. So that's what that feature does. But what the change was in 14 is that Apple is actually making it very in your face by forcing a dialogue to show for every single application, just like you get a dialogue for location services, for instance, right? And so the old like toggle, no one ever touched because it's buried in settings. But this toggle is right in your face and the users have to explicitly say yes. So, you know, Facebook, all these ad SDKs, including like some ones that aren't just about advertising, just like ones that want to help track users around for like if you follow like an ad on the web and you go and download an app from the App Store, if you don't allow this tracking, there's no way for them to retie up the advertising. Or if you like buy something on a website and you want to connect it to the app, like there are legitimate uses, but the primary use case is targeted advertising. And so all the advertisers were getting mad that Apple had like flung these people on June, and by September they weren't going to have a way to do it because they expect most people to just say, no, we don't want to be tracked, right? And Apple seems to have had conversations with these people and decided that they're going to take it slower. They still want to do it, but they're just delaying the timeline. So now the feature will be in iOS 14, but the dialogue won't be there until, you know, like March or whenever they decide to do it. And this is quite common. Like, I can remember a few times when Apple's kind of announced like a new policy in June, and then before the first version actually ships, they talk with the developer community and the app community and be like, you know, we still want to do this, but we understand that you need more time to adjust, or you need even if there was like an alternative way to do it, it just takes resources and development time, and maybe Apple didn't appreciate that these companies wouldn't be ready, especially in the light of the pandemic stuff. You know, work processes have been disrupted, so there's some compassion there. And like, because I remember they had all those rules for like kids apps that they were going to enforce like on the dot, and then that got delayed, and then they changed the rules slightly, and there's been other ones in the past too. This is just like the latest one of those. I think it's understandable. Some people are saying that, you know, Apple is just like caving to Facebook because Facebook's really mad about it, but there is a wider story than just like what Facebook wanted, so I can understand it. If they drop the feature entirely, then you can say they've just like caved to the advertisers, which goes against their, you know, privacy first ideas. But they're just being practical and like, okay, we wanted to do this in September, but we realized that the rest of the community isn't, and the ecosystem isn't ready to move along with us, so we're just going to push it back by a few months. That's the idea.
Okay, not too bad.
Yeah, it's fine. Like, ideally, they would announce it with a timeline in June and then stick to that timeline that was actually realistic, rather than like announcing stuff to ship immediately and then having to, you know, change it around. But there you go.
Yeah, you can't shoehorn everything into the one schedule that is mostly dominated by when a new iPhone comes out.
Right, and especially in light of like all this, you know, antitrust stuff. There's been a few companies complaining that like Apple just springs rules on us on a dime, and we have to, you know, expend a lot of engineering resources and money to adopt and to and react. Meanwhile, Apple's had internal foresight on this stuff for months and months and months, and they can adjust, you know, at their own will. Basically, these third parties complain that Apple, as well as with the monetary advantages, Apple gets it can update its apps internally, like on its own schedule, and then the third party community is always having to catch up to what Apple announces. So there are different factors at play here, but as long as they don't drop the policy completely, because I think it was a good idea, I don't have a problem with them just pushing the dates back a bit.
Yep. All right, let's talk about our first sponsor this week.
Sure. Smart investing means having a diversified portfolio, a combination of stocks, bonds, mutual funds. If you've ever looked at the details of the most successful portfolios, though, you usually find a diversified set of real estate. Real estate is not easily available to individual investors until now. Fundrise enables anyone to access these asset classes. Fundrise makes it easy to build a portfolio of institutional quality real estate investments. Whether you're just starting out in the investing field or you're looking to grow, Fundrise has got you covered. It's an investing platform that can make investing in high quality real estate as simple as investing in the stock market. You can build a stable cash flow with a dividend-based portfolio or look for long-term growth with appreciation. Fundrise supports all pathways. Fundrise manages more than $1 billion in assets for 130,000 investors. Since 2014, the platform has averaged 8.7 to 12.4% annual returns. Investors have made in excess of $79 million in dividends alone. Fundrise connects you with a team of real estate professionals that vet and manage all the investments. You can track your portfolio's performance through the easy-to-use Fundrise website. So you can start building your better portfolio today. Get started at fundrise.com/happyhour to have your first 90 days of advisory fees waived. That's fundrise.com/happyhour to get your first 90 days of advisory fees waived. fundrise.com/happyhour.
All right, thanks, Fundrise. So a lot of new hardware news this week in terms of rumors. And I think most of this comes from our friend Mark Gurman at Bloomberg. First up is this iPad Air that we talked about last week. I guess it's iPad Air 4 that we're talking about.
Yes.
And this is the one that it's kind of a whole new product in terms of like the design and everything. It's taking the iPad Pro 2018 and 2020, full screen design and bringing that to a non-pro iPad for the first time, and making some interesting choices like not having Face ID but having Touch ID on the sleep wake button. So there's some really interesting things there about it. And then I think the most interesting thing is how much it will cost compared to an iPad Pro for what you get. What's new with the iPad Air 4 this week?
Yeah, so obviously last week we were basing our expectations off this kind of like semi-sketchy manual, right? Photos of a manual that was written in French. And, there, you know, it looked decent. We couldn't see any evidence of Photoshopping or anything. But it is, at the end of the day, kind of this, like, you know, unsourced, unprovenant manual. This week, it seems to be confirmed by the fact that Bloomberg is saying that Apple is indeed readying an edge-to-edge iPad for the fall. It's basically, it's cool to see, because they're basically taking the best bits of the higher-end line and bringing it to a lower price point. It's not going to be identical. Like, I think some people were releasing these leaked schematics where the actual thickness of the bezels is going to be slightly thicker than what they are on the iPad Pro. And obviously you're going to have the Touch ID situation rather than Face ID, although some people actually like that, because Face ID on the iPad is fine, but you do cover it up with your hands quite often, right? Like, there are ergonomic reasons why people like Touch ID, so they're going to bring Touch ID to the power button, supposedly, with the iPad Air 4, and that allows them to bring, you know, most of the industrial design of the big one to the lower-end model. The open question is whether they're going to do a magic keyboard for the iPad Air. Like, so obviously they have the smart connector already, which supports the smart keyboard folio, but they only make the, you know, the floating cantilever design one at the moment for the iPad Pro models. Will they make one for the iPad Air? Nobody's said for sure. I expect they will, because Apple likes money, and those kind of accessories are very good profit makers, and they provide, you know, laptop style experiences.
Yeah, sounds very expensive.
Yeah, like that. But the iPad Air is what starts at $499 at the moment, and the cases are like those Magic Keyboard cases are like $279, just the small one. Like the pricing definitely is working out.
Yeah, but they've at least priced the Pro one so high that they have a lot of room to price the Air ones high as well, without being as much as the iPad itself.
Yeah, you have the same awkwardness with like the $329 iPad, where they also try and sell you the Smart Key Portfolio for that as well, and that's also pretty expensive relative to the price of the actual tablet. So they're not afraid to do that kind of stuff. Presumably, this iPad Air will also support the second generation Magic Pencil, Apple Pencil, because it's going to have USB-C instead of Lightning. So, and the new design, so it should support charging the new Pencil with the magnetic attachment on the side.
Yep, and then that's pretty much it for iPad. I mean, the big story there was that it's gone from in a brochure to in a major publication that's being reported as coming.
Yeah, it went from like 60% confidence to like 90% confidence. So.
Right, yeah, or higher, yeah. iPhone 12. So there's been a lot of talk about the midnight green color that was introduced with the iPhone 12 Pro and 12 Pro Max. That being a one-off for this past year, and that some version of blue being the new color. What's all the story there, and what else is new with iPhone 12 this week?
Yeah, so basically everyone now, including this Bloomberg report, is saying that midnight green will be replaced by a dark blue option instead, like a deep blue or something, which I'm all for, because we spoke about this on the show when midnight green was announced. Like, no, it didn't float my boat. Like, it just reminds me too much of, like, I don't know, war or like army stuff. Like, it's not my domain. Deep blue or a dark blue color, I'd be all for. Like, that's
your domain.
Yeah, blue. Yeah, give me a dark blue and I like, my favorite colors on the iPhone have been the jet black one, which is iPhone 7, but that scratched so much that it was unpractical, but it looked cool. And then the matte black iPhone, whatever one it was, I think it was iPhone 7 as well.
The
matte black. Yeah, they had the matte black one. I like the matte black. And then the slate blue color of the iPhone 5. That's like the best colors. And this sounds like we're going to get some sort of return to that.
You know, also, simultaneously getting
the iPhone 5 design, because the sides are getting, you know, flattened.
I hadn't thought about it much recently, I hadn't thought about it in a long time. But with slate, you also had an iPad mini in that color. Remember that?
Yes.
Yeah, it reminded me of like Batman's suit or something. I don't know why, but good stuff.
Yeah, because obviously then they went to like the aluminium stuff, so they went away from
space gray.
And they had like the worst iPhone times were like when the iPhone 6 with the annoying lines on the back. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, this is definitely today.
Like, the 6 was cool because the screens got bigger, right? And it had the curved glass, but the actual just like raw look of the phones, probably like the worst one Apple's ever done. Like, if you actually rank them, just purely an industrial design.
Yeah, it's like covered in like a wrapper, and you know, like you want to peel those lines off.
Yeah, they look like packaging materials rather than like things. When you look back on them, it doesn't look good.
Yeah, and if you compare that to like whenever Steve Jobs was like owning up to the iPhone 4 having those four antenna lines, like that was way not as bad, because the back of the 6 design is like webs of lines.
Yeah. And they slowly, you know, with the 6S, they made the lines less prominent, and then, you know, they finally got rid of them by going to all glass backs. But anyway, back to the Bloomberg report. Obviously, Mark's confirming what we all know with the 5.4-inch model, the 6.7-inch big model, and the two 6.1-inch models. He says that there's going to be a staggered release, so the non-pro ones, so the 5.4-inch and the base model 6.1-inch, will be coming out in October. And then the Pro models will follow in a few weeks after that. So maybe like the first week in November or something.
October could be the whole month of iPhones.
Right.
Every week you get a new iPhone.
And in terms of what's different between the Pro and non-Pro, well, definitely the LiDAR sensor is only going to be on the Pro ones. Beyond that, you have the screen size difference on the, you know, on the Max. But we still don't know if there's going to be anything else. The highest end one will apparently support the fastest speed 5G, which is the millimeter wave 5G, and that's going to be like the main difference. Just based on what we know so far, it feels like pretty small differentiation between the non-pro and the pro, just especially on that 6.1-inch model. Like, if all the difference you're going to get is the LiDAR scanner, I guess you're going to get a third camera versus dual camera. That's probably how they're going to frame it. But it feels like they could do with something else in the mix. There for a while, there were rumors of the, you know, ProMotion 120 hertz stuff, but those have definitely died away. sadly. So it just seems like we're going to get normal displays this year. The other interesting thing in Mark's report is that he quotes or, you know, paraphrases discussions with Apple engineers who've been using the prototypes. They said they think that the new 6.7-inch screen is one of this year's most notable improvements, and the few tests found that current 5G networks are not improving the connection speeds that much, which, if your best feature is the 6.7-inch screen size, I'm not interested. Like, I don't want a phone bigger than what I've got now. Like, if you want to make a 6.1 inch phone but with smaller bezels so it fits in like the 5.8-inch phone, that's fine. But if it got any bigger than like the iPhone 11 size, I'm not interested. Like, I don't want the max phone when it was 6.5 inches and I still don't want it when it's 6.7, right?
Yeah, I enjoy them, but like I don't enjoy them long term. They're neat to use, and when you see them, like, oh, that's really cool. And maybe like I'm sure that there are, like, there's an audience that's like, you know, you can't live without that bigger phone. For me, I always go back to the smaller one, and then it feels like it's just nicer, that like to miniaturize it that way is just nicer. And then I would even take it a little bit smaller.
Yeah. Well, like, or the 5.4 inch. Yeah, for sure. They're going to be more of what, like, I think most of the tech community looks at. Like, although you can't deny that the big phones are very popular in the market, right? Like, for me, the big phones are like the things that are good in theory, but then practically you don't want them. Kind of like how it'd be nice if you could just use your iPhone without it being in a case, but that's just like so dangerous that you have to put it in a case, right? It's like, you're going to say you don't use a case, aren't you? But
no, I was just going to ask how you were doing today.
My iPhone's in a case. It's always been in a case. I can't.
There are times when I have to have a case. So I was caseless for a long, long time. And then I wasn't caseless for a long, long time. And now I use the smart battery case when, like, I have to have a case for something, you know? And then other than that, I don't. And the back of the phone and the sides are perfect. The front of the phone is, like, scratched to no end. And, I don't know why, but it's horribly scratched in the front.
Yeah, I mean, they've definitely changed the glass, like, makeup.
The case wouldn't really help.
Yeah, so, I don't know, it's they made trade-offs where they've like kind of stopped it from shattering, but it's still easily, it's more easy to scratch, basically.
Definitely, yeah. Which is, yeah. I mean, when the screen's on, it's not as big of a deal. There are a couple in there that I can feel.
Yeah, like they made it more easy for them to have like small scratches that you don't see when the screen turns on, but I guess that's the trade-off you take versus having like a big crack down the middle of the glass. And about the thing about it being like the 5G feature being not very impactful, like I've been saying that for months. Like, the biggest reason that, you know, Apple wants to push 5G phones out, I say this with mostly truth, is that the carriers want to promote 5G. Like, the carriers want people to upgrade their devices. They're clamoring onto this 5G thing as if it's going to, like, change the world overnight. But if you actually look in real-world use cases, most people aren't going to even notice, I don't think. Like, apart from it saying 5G in the corner, which if you have AT&T devices, you're already set on that one. The
5G.
Yeah, like it's like what, like
only when I travel.
The super fast 5G is, you have to be like right next to the towers to even notice it. The lowest end 5G, you're going to get what, like 80 meg down? Okay, great. That's more than the, you know, 20 meg that you probably get right now. But what you can do with that difference on the phone, like download a video slightly faster? I don't know. Like, you've got to tell me something that's of any value of having a 5G chip in there and having a 5G radio. Like,
use 4K on YouTube on iOS.
Oh, come on, you know, like, the
better.
People, right, I swear that's a placebo as well. On the iPhone screen size, can you really tell the difference between the 4K version and the low version?
I'm
pretty sure on 20 meg, if you've got 20 megs earlier, you can stream 4K anyway. Like, it's more than enough.
Yeah. Like, one thing that's, like, horribly slow for me, I don't think it's, like, a network thing, I think it's Apple servers, is iCloud Photos, whenever you're going to, like, have the full image, it's horribly slow. Even on the best,
it's slow on my home broadband though as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same.
So if you're on a 5G network, it's not going to make iCloud Photos faster.
Yeah.
Like, and the LiDAR scanner is the same deal, right? Like, I'd love to have like a survey of 2020 iPad Pro owners. Have they used the LiDAR scanner once? Like, what are you going to use it for?
Can't live without it.
Nothing. The only thing I think they're going for is the AR stuff with the Find My tags and the like device location.
LiDAR will be cooler on the phone than it is on the iPad, I think.
Sure. But you're still going to have a bit of stretch to, like, you know, upgrade your phone just for a LiDAR scanner, right?
No, like, and I think this is a year where it's pretty clear that if you've got an 11 series phone, like, mm-hmm. you're set for another year. If you've got what, 10S, 10R, like, pretty doing pretty good. If you've got a 10, like, you had a 10 for a long time.
Yeah, like,
the speeds are like on that, but if you've got anything older than a 10, then it's an awesome upgrade. Maybe from a 10, it's a pretty good upgrade too, but from a 10S, 10R, 11, especially 11 Pro. It's,
yeah, I think from the 11 series, there's no motivation.
But we do love new designs and new screen sizes. And this is a year where we have both of those things, even if functionally there's not a big difference. And that's not to, you know, be ignored, because I know both of us love a new design.
Sure.
Design gets stale.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it'd be interesting to see quite how different this year's design is. Like, I mean, obviously we see all the CAD mockups and the dummies and stuff, and it does seem not like it's not a massive industrial design change. Like, they're flattening the sides. Like it's not like going from like an iPhone 8 to an iPhone 10.
Yeah, I mean, it'll feel different in your hand and everything.
Yeah, it will feel different. Like,
going from the 5S to the 6 felt really different, even mm-hmm. though it was, and they had different screen sizes too, but.
Yeah, like, I'm sure this phone is perfectly fine and it'll sell perfectly well, but I'm not, like, jumping at the bit for it, right? Like, it's just not a good year for year-over-year upgrades.
For year-over-year upgrades,
what we're saying. Like, if it had promotion, that'd be more enticing, but it doesn't know that's going to happen.
Yeah. Apple Watch stuff. This is mm-hmm. interesting. So, this again comes from Bloomberg, Mark Gurman's report for Bloomberg, saying that there will be 2 new Apple Watch models this year. A Series 6 and something that's like a Series 3S, where you kind of look at the Series 3 as like the template for this new watch, and you know make it faster. You do something about it that makes it more modern and less long in the tooth. Although, I mean, the Apple Watch doesn't really age in the way that, like, maybe even a phone does. So the Series 3 is still pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, the Series 3 processor is a bit far behind. If you expect another performance upgrade this year in the Series 6, yeah, then
Series 3 is only one generation behind Series 5 in terms of speed.
Yeah, that is true. But you don't get, like, full detection or even ECG and stuff like that. So I think there's room for it. Like, obviously, it's not going to be as big a difference as what we see on, like, the phone line between, like, iPhone XR and iPhone XS.
Is a formula that works with iPads. So take an existing iPad design that isn't, like, the state-of-the-art and put in a better chip inside, basically.
Yeah, you rev it. Like, and again, we actually spoke about this in the question-answer section of a previous episode, because it was rumored, like, on one of these Twitter accounts, and now it's been, you know, verified by and validated by the Bloomberg report. I think it makes sense. Like, they've obviously been happy to keep the Series 3 around last year, and they don't seem to be able to do the new design, you know, the all screen, or the, you know, the thinner bezel curved display style Apple Watch at a cheaper price, because that's why they kept the Series 3 around rather than changing out with the Series 4. And same with this year, it seems like for them to be able to keep the lower price points, because, you know, like, right now the Series 3 sells for $199, and maybe they're even going to go lower, they have to just carry on with the old design but give it, like, a new chip, make it compatible with the modern like, headphone stuff, with, you know, like, a modern W chip, probably.
Sure.
Bluetooth 5, and then, like, international SOS callings are something they added with Series 5, which they could easily add for Series 3. Like, all the stuff that's cheap, and mm-hmm. then give it a new processor and then just carry on selling it. Like, I think that makes sense if you get my drift.
You know, they keep doing new watch faces and watch OS 6 and 7 that don't go to the Series 3. I wonder if that's a concern at all. Like, if they, but there's only one new watch face in watchOS 7, the Chronograph Pro. I wonder if they'll if they market this kind of Series 3S type of thing, if they'll make new watch faces for watchOS 7 for it, just for the sake of, like, marketing it. You know, like, this is a new watch face, because right now it's pretty limited. I think it's the numeral faces,
right? Because most of the new faces that have come out have been designed for the bigger curved screens, right? Not the squared off ones. So that is probably the biggest change you notice if you are using a Series 3, is the watch face selection is just not as good.
Yeah.
And maybe they could even do, like, a Series 3 with an always on display at some point. Like, maybe that's not this year, but next year. They could carry on with the industrial design of the old one, but just have the screen stay on. Like, I don't think the always-on part is the bit that's expensive. Like, I think it's the rest of the design and the curved edges and the bigger screen.
Yeah, and then Series 6, is there any information more about what to expect from it? Or is it
sadly not. We're still just working on, like, blood oxygen sensor.
Blood oxygen sensor, yeah. You had me watch the David Blaine Ascension thing, where David Blaine ascends via balloons and then parachutes down from super high. And they were doing a lot of blood oxygen sensor, you know, readings with, like, the medical ones that you get, and you just, like, put on your finger. But it was like, oh, they're looking a lot at blood oxygen sensor in this elevation test.
Well, if you're doing if you're jumping out of the plane on a regular basis, they are useful. In day-to-day life, we'll see. I'm sure there's some, like, heart condition or life condition.
There'll be a story around it.
Yeah, you know, like how ECG and has the regular heart notifications and then atrial fibrillation stuff. I'm sure there's some kind of detection that they can do passively through the blood oxygen sensor as well.
It feels like so many years ago when we first reported that this was coming this year.
It has been a long time coming. It is interesting though, like, when the Apple Watch first came out, there were the rumors it's going to come with like 10 biometric sensors, and then it basically just shipped with the heart rate sensor. And then, you know, with Series 4, they added ECG and a better gyroscope, which enabled the full detection stuff. But that's been about it. Like, this is the first kind of new sensor apart from ECG. Like, when I think when we look back on the original watches, we were expecting, like, every single year they were going to add some crazy new sensor that would measure something else, when actually they've focused on other features and been much more timid about, like, expanding.
Yeah, I mean, they've added LTE.
Right.
They've added GPS, they've added LTE, they've added a barometer, they've added a compass. Like, all the things that are in iPhones that you take for granted, they've added to the watch. And then there's some things from the watch that get thrown back to the phone. But
yeah. Just in terms of, like, raw health sensors, I guess they've just got a lot of mileage out of heart rate sensor and accelerometer, basically.
Certainly. Yeah. All right, let's take another sponsor break here.
Yep. We were sponsored by Pillow a few months ago, and I'm glad to say they are back. So getting good night's sleep is underrated, but with a little help, it can be life-changing. Pillow is an all-in-one sleep tracking solution to help you be more aware of your sleep patterns and discover what might be affecting your sleep quality. If you have an Apple Watch, tracking your sleep is as easy as wearing it to bed. Pillow will track and analyze your sleep automatically. One of Pillow's most loved features is the ability to get a detailed heart rate diagram of every sleep session. Compare your sleep quality with your weight, steps, caffeine consumption, and many other health metrics to discover how they might be affecting how you sleep. Enable the recording mode and Pillow will save the sounds that you make during sleep. From sleep talking, to sleep apnea, snoring, just random unexpected noises during the night. Use recording and you can find out what's going on. Find out why you're being disrupted. A lot of users have been surprised by the results. Pillow is, of course, very privacy minded. All your sleep and audio data is encrypted and stored on your own device. And when it syncs to iCloud, it's using end-to-end encryption. Pillow doesn't have user accounts, so you can use it anonymously, and it won't send your personal data anywhere else. Naps boost your focus, creativity, and overall well-being. If you've been working from home, you can also take naps using Pillow's power nap modes. If you need an alarm, Pillow can wake you up using iPhone, Apple Watch, or iPad. If you have WatchOS 6, Pillow uses the new extended runtime APIs to minimize battery consumption on the watch. Pillow is available on the App Store for iPhone, Apple Watch, and iPad. Discover all of Pillow's features at naybox.com/pillow. NEYBOX.com/pillow. Sleep well and stay safe. Our thanks to Pillow for sponsoring Happy Hour.
All right. So we've got some Apple TV hardware stuff here, which is...
Again, kind of, from the Bloomberg Report.
Again, from the Bloomberg Report. Yeah, and this Apple TV stuff is not... like, it's... man, this is a long rumor cycle for a new Apple TV. What are we talking about this week?
Yeah, I mean, since what, like the beginning of the year, a 9to5 Mac found like code references to an Apple TV refresh with either like an A12 or an A13 chip. There's been some talk of an A14 chip version as well. And then if like 6 months ago, a few people were saying that it's basically ready to go and then it's going to come out, but then it never did. And so we've just been kind of coasting and we're kind of expecting to come out this fall, but not really expecting much from it because it's just going to basically be like a spec bump, hopefully a lower price to go along with it, because $179 starting price for the 4K version is very expensive. But again, pricing we won't know till Apple announces it. What Bloomberg says is to maybe minimize your hopes even more because it might not even come out this year. So the Apple TV update, which will probably be a similar form factor. They're not going to go to like a stick or anything. It's still going to be a little box. Might not be ready until next year. That's the direct wording from the Bloomberg report. It does say it's going to feature an upgraded remote control, including a feature that will allow you to locate your Apple TV remote if you lose it. So similar to like, you know, making your iPhone ping, you'll be able to go in the Find My app and make your Apple TV remote and make a noise. You can find it if it's falling down the back of the sofa. Good feature. And a lot of people want it. Like, I follow a Twitter column about Apple TV stuff, and there are a lot of people adding Apple, like, I've lost my remote. How do I find it using Find My iPhone or something, or make it support Find My iPhone? And obviously right now the Apple TV remote does not have a speaker in it, so it can't do that. What will probably happen with the new remote is they'll integrate the UWB chip. So it'll be almost like it had an AirTag attached to it, because we also believe that AirTags are launching this year, finally.
What's AirTags? I haven't heard that in a while.
The UWB, you know, smart finding thing where you better hold your phone and get a little balloon that points to where it is in the room. The tower competitor. Ultra wideband indeed. The tower competitor thing. It seems like Apple's not only going to release the tags, they're also going to integrate the technology into maybe like the AirPod Studio over headphones and the Apple TV remote. So you'll be able to get like a nice finding experience just by holding up your phone and seeing a little arrow that points where your remote's hidden. So that's a nice feature. I think people obviously want more than just a remote locator from a redesigned Apple TV remote, right? And unfortunately, the Bloomberg report does not go into any more detail about what's going to change there. I don't have huge problems with the design of Apple TV remote, but I acknowledge that a lot of people do, so they need to change something. Like, even if they just made it slightly bigger, so just slightly more room to do the gestures, I think that would help.
Yeah, my mother-in-law, she's a teacher, and she's quarantining right now because she has symptoms, which is unfortunate. So she's like stuck in the bedroom pretty much, and she got out the Apple TV 3 that we get to her like several years ago, and she was like using it to watch Hulu and stuff, and then the app, like the remote, the silver remote battery died in it. It would only go down, and she was trying to like type on a keyboard with only down being available, and the phone app wasn't working very well, and so the request was that I bring her a new battery for that remote. And I just pulled a Fire TV stick off of one of the TVs and bought her that. It's like, this is going to be a much better experience, you know. And
yeah, like, I love the Apple TV.
Mm-hmm. The new, I mean, the Apple TV 4 and 4K are a good product.
They're definitely the best. I'd call them the best in their class, but they're just very expensive. Yeah. Like, they need to get the price down. Yeah.
Anytime someone's been holding up for years for an Apple TV and they're about to buy one now, it's like, you can't really say don't, because it isn't like, you know, we're a month out from a new one.
But could be March.
Yeah.
This is unfortunate. But I mean, unless it's still coming. and upgrade your remote control at least give people some hope that they're going to do something more drastic, right? Although the last time they upgraded the Siri remote, they put a white ring on the home button and that was it.
Yeah. Do you see their remote review that's been going around tech sites past week, where it's like
that annoys me so much. Yeah, that annoys me so much.
With a big logo on it. Yeah.
What do they call it? The button remote or the function remote? Whatever it's called.
Yeah. Function. Right. Yeah. Air your grievances.
Any IR remote can do the exact same thing. You can train any IR remote to control the Apple TV through the settings of the Apple TV. And I believe that function remote goes through the exact same process. You have to set it up through the settings. It's not a collaboration with Apple. It's nothing fancy. It's an IR remote. Just go, if you want one, you can go to the Apple store and you can get the Apple old IR remote, like the one that came with the original Apple TV. If you want to, you can use that. Or you can just buy any universal remote from Amazon, or one you've got lying around the house. Like, I understand people's grievances with the Siri remote, but don't go out and buy these special ones that are like made for Apple TV. They don't do anything different. They're just IR remotes. That's that. Yep. So don't think it's something that it isn't. Like,
every time I saw a picture of one of those on Twitter, I was like, oh, this is going to annoy Benjamin. I mean, I feel the same way. I think they're silly, but yeah.
Like, your best choice, if you don't like Siri remote, is just go and buy a universal remote, and then you can control your actual TV set. You can control your, you know, other things in the living room and the Apple TV all from one remote with physical buttons.
Yeah. All right, MacBook Pro, or not MacBook Pro, 12-inch MacBook, the least pro of the bunch, but the most portable. There's a rumor about it this week, but it's not like, this is not from the Bloomberg report.
Right. We finished with Bloomberg now.
And it's not from Coil, and it's not from us. So it's one that we're not so sure about. But, you know, the other half of this, I think, is that it makes sense that there's a 12-inch MacBook with Apple's chip inside to replace the 12-inch MacBook that went away, because that would be the perfect to have, you know, an iPad-class chip, except they're going to have, you know, better than iPad-class chips in these machines. What's sketchy about this, and kind of what are the claims that we've seen from this?
Yeah, so this came from, like, the China Times, and obviously Min-Chi Kuo has been pretty up on the ARM roadmap. Before Apple even said it was going to come out this year, he was saying that the first ARM Mac would ship before the end of the year, and it would be a 13-inch MacBook Pro. So this obviously isn't a 13-inch MacBook Pro, and, you know, we'd always trust Kuo over this random website, but there you go. But I think this makes sense, and they're probably going to do something of this form, whether it's the end of the year or whether it's early next year or something. Who knows about the exact timing? But basically, the website said that Apple's doing, they're going to bring back the 12-inch MacBook based on the A14X chip, and it will get 15 to 20 hour battery life, which is, you know, whatever.
Better than any iPad, which has 10 at most.
Right.
Which is like, and better obviously, than any phone.
The laptops have more space to put batteries because they have two parts. Like, so it makes sense that the battery life is very good. And that's what everyone's been wanting, right? Like, they either want super good performance or they want super long battery life. And this 12-inch MacBook will come back with pretty decent performance running on an A14X chip. Like, the A14 chip will outperform most of Apple's current Mac lineup, like current MacBook lineup, easily.
And these are competing with, like, at least from the original 12-inch MacBook, the super thin form factor version, Intel Core M processor that they later classified the version as like an i3.
Right.
And it was still basically the same thing. This is the fanless MacBook, which is very cool because, you know, with the ARM Mac idea, there's a desire that there would be no fan like iPads and iPhones, but there's also a need for higher temperature thresholds to be tolerable. So then there's a need for a fan if you want to actually get performance that you can't get from an iPad or an iPhone.
Right, like the future ARM lineup might have this 12-inch and then like the MacBook Air being fanless, and then they have the MacBook Pro line, which run, you know, more performant Apple Silicon that still require fans for cooling, right? So I think this probably makes sense. And they specifically said it's going to use the A14X chip. Apple did say they're making like a separate line of Apple Silicon for their machine.
The family, yeah.
Yeah, but especially for their lower end products, they'd be fine basically just using an A14X.
But would this be a $1,300 MacBook like before? And what do they do with the keyboard? Because this is where the bad keyboard began.
Yeah. And there are some rumors that they're actually going to use the butterfly keyboard.
Oh,
for this. Yeah, which I think would be like suicide if they do that, because everyone hates the butterfly keyboard.
Yeah.
Like the A14X chip, it could be basically identical, but Apple would still name it, and whatever they're going to brand the Apple Silicon line, they'd call it a different name even if the chip's the same. And for the entry level like 12-inch machine, the performance profile of the A14X would be perfectly fine. So I think Apple would be like, it's the M4 or whatever they call it, but it could just be the A14X chip under the hood. Just like how the developer transition kit runs on an A12Z, right? Like, you only need very minor adjustments to make it work inside the Mac. And then they'll have, like, truly different silicon that'll be running in, like, the 13-inch MacBook Pro, where they've pushed the performance for, you know, the laptop form factor rather than just replicating what an iPad can give you.
Yeah. All right, I'll let you take this next one.
Yeah, so John Prosser, he's been tweeting a lot of stuff this year, and one area where he's been very accurate is release dates on the Apple Store. So he, like, very impressively predicted that the iPhone SE would come out in like the third week of April, in like the first week of March. So that is a long time, very, very, very accurate. And he did the same.
He was alone in doing that too.
Yeah, exactly. He wasn't like
corroborated or anything like that.
Right, and. You know, I was doubtful, but he turned out to be completely right. So big kudos. He also did the same thing with the iPad update and the MacBook update that we just had come through, and the iMac update. The day of the iMac hardware refresh came out, he said there was going to be an iMac update later in the day, and indeed there was. Like, so on release dates, I'm backing him all the way because he seems very, very accurate.
He actually makes the decisions about this.
Yeah, he's choosing when they're going to come out. Well, what's funny is he has pronounced that there will be something Apple hardware new on this store on September 8th, so the coming Tuesday. There'll be something new. And the current theory is that it's going to be the aforementioned iPad Air, the edge-to-edge iPad Air. that is what people believe it's going to be. So the iPad Air update is could be available for sale as soon as next week, which is pretty exciting.
That's cool. Yeah. Well, we could have 3 weeks in a row talking about it, from the idea to the confirmation to the availability.
Yeah, and to continue Prost's success story, in August, he said that the week commencing September 7th, i.e. the same week as September 8th, Apple release the new iPad Air and the Apple Watch hardware. Personally, I don't think the Apple Watch hardware is going to happen, and I think even if you ask Prost, you'd be less confident about that one. But the iPad one makes sense. Like, the Apple Watch and the iPhone are so intertwined, it makes sense for them to do them at the same time, because a lot of times people just buy both, right? The iPads are separate, and they've done, you know, iPads on their own plenty of times, so they could do the iPad basically with a press release update next week, and then we'll see the iPhones and the Apple Watches in like either a late September or first week of October event.
Yeah, you don't have to have a new iPhone with a new Apple Watch. I think the only scenario where that would be a problem is if you were switching and you wanted to have the new iPhone and the newest Apple Watch, and then you'd be kind of in limbo for a few weeks, but that's pretty specific. So they certainly could do an Apple Watch release before an iPhone release, especially when iPhones are kind of stalled throughout the fall. But it would be different.
I mean, just look historically, right? They've announced iPads on their own. So far, the Apple Watch has been always tied with an iPhone event. Even the first one, even when they were just teasing it, they did it on the iPhone 6 event. So if you look historically, they always put them together.
So that's next week. We have things to look forward to next week.
Yeah, hopefully on Happy Hour next week, we'll be able to talk about the iPad Air. It's gone from sketchy rumor to pretty accurate from Bloomberg to maybe released within the space of a fortnight, which is pretty exciting.
Yes. And this is something we were going to mention last week and kind of ran out of time, but Apple TV Plus and augmented reality. So kind of, you know, one of the first uses of AR that's kind of neat. Apple, that's not, you know, furniture from IKEA placing and stuff like that, where it's first party, it's Apple services, and they're using AR in a way that they think makes sense. So what is Apple TV Plus AR?
Yeah, so again, Mark Gurman at Bloomberg, we had a lot of Mark Gurman stories this week, always, you know, we used to work with him, he's great.
It's that time of the year.
Yeah, Gurman said that Apple is developing bonus content features for the TV app, which include like augmented reality experiences for its original shows. He gave the example of if you're watching For Mankind, you could then go and get like a model of the rocket shown in your living room, maybe perched on the living room table and see it like fly away. And you're completely right that like Apple keeps talking about like how AR is the future, and there's been, you know, the ongoing rumblings they're working on this headset. But if you just look brass tacks, what is new from, like, what can you do with an augmented reality experience on an Apple device today? First party from Apple, there's basically nothing. Like, they would say the Measure app, but, you know, it's not really AR, right? Like, and they might even say Memojis, but again, it's not really an AR feature, even though it's using AR kit, it's not really an AR experience. Like, the proper things that you think of as, you know, immersive augmented reality experiences all come from...
I had a cool AR experience where there's this NASA book that's like blank pages, but the first few pages you have an app. It's not an AR kit at all.
Yeah.
But you aim the app at the book, and this like picture show, like a reel, plays through. And actually, maybe it's like every page is like that, but it's really neat. I tweeted a link to it a while ago, and like it didn't get that much interest. But I thought, like, I guess like the experience, like the wow factor, isn't holding the phone and seeing it, but it's neat, but it's very specific, and it's not AR kit.
Yeah, like, so this would be basically the first AR experience coming directly from Apple. I guess they might.
Right.
I guess they might release the AR thing for the AirTags before, right?
Like, but even that's like you could use that entirely without that feature, kind of Pokemon Go style,
right.
Or like,
yeah,
you know, use a map. With this stuff, like, it's probably there's not a non-AR equivalent, maybe. Otherwise,
I guess just like
video.
Just like a bonus feature video segment. Like,
right.
This could be really cool, or it could just be like...
It could be gimmicky, like 3D.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the Apple News Plus app was, like, introduced with the live covers and stuff. I love showing that off on the stage, like in March 2019. And that was basically inconsequential, right? Like, it could be like that, or it could be something pretty interesting. Like, I think if you could like get a 3D representation of like a set, like if the morning show set, or like the For Mankind, like inside the spacecraft, like the command terminal, if you could load that up on your phone, like move it around and see what was going on, I think that'd be really cool. So hopefully they're going to do stuff like that. Gurman says this was originally destined to come out this year, but production issues have pushed it back, as well as software issues. Obviously, any update to the TV app pricks my ears up, because I'm hoping for even bigger changes. And if they're working on this, maybe they're working on other stuff. So that's the other reason I'm happy about this, because at least they're giving it attention.
Yeah.
And like, and when we posted this, I got some like snarky responses that were like, you know, why are they doing this? Why aren't they prioritizing, you know, better recommendations, a proper tab and stuff? And like, I get it, but that's never how Apple's going to work. They're going to address customer feedback and do follow their own roadmaps. If they want to do this and they think it's cool, they're going to do it.
I mean, you're showing the person to complain about what they're not doing.
Yeah, like if they work on the TV app, I'm happy, because it means they work on the TV app, right? They have resources to do it. So even if it takes like, you know, even if this comes out first, but then it still shows that they are investing in that area. The same with the news app, right? Like when Apple News Plus first came out, I was pretty critical of the experience and it was pretty bad. But they showed pretty about every other month, they rolled out a decent change that actually made the News Plus experience better. So far with the TV app, they haven't done anything. So that's why I'm still like so persistent about it, because at least with News Plus, I like, you see they recognize the mistake and they've actually changed stuff. TV app at the moment is in the limbo where you just kind of have to cross your fingers and hope that it's getting better, and then complain until it does. So at least the fact that they are working on, you know, more sophisticated stuff for the TV app experience, it shows that they're investing in it. And so if this comes out with a bigger TV app overhaul, I'll be thrilled. So I'm looking forward to it. Even as the feature on its own, I think it could be cool for like some bonus content stuff. And I wish they would do more bonus content stuff for TV Plus, to be honest. Like, they have a few different like little like featurettes, but I like seeing behind the scenes. I like bloopers, and so far they haven't done any of that. So, and a kind of AR experience is very like premium brand on the nose of the kind of like Apple TV Plus.
Is a podcast AR
vision? I guess it has to be 3D. Imagine if they do. Actually, that was the other thing I thought. What if they did like AR director's commentary? So they got those kind of like 360-degree cameras, and they could like record a scene being filmed, and you could watch it back and see it in real time. You could see everyone in the studio. Like, there are some opportunities to like make something that's meaningful here, and not just be like a dumb gimmick.
Yeah, yeah.
You want to do some questions?
Yeah, let's do some questions. I will say the documentary stuff that they've shown this week, the motorcycle stuff, has me excited.
Yeah, Long Way Up, that comes out on September 18th.
Yeah. So they're doing electric bikes.
Yep.
And electric trucks.
Yeah, the trucks are the support vehicles. So it's centered around the motorcycle bikes. And apparently they're going to go like across South America just by charging at people's houses. So that'd be...
Yeah, there were some comments on that. Like, there were some quotes there, like, some places you just can't charge. There's not infrastructure. And so you have to rely on the kindness of people knocking on their doors and asking if you can charge there. And some say no and some say yes. I would try that, but...
And I will say, in just on terms of like Apple's original content slate, like they have 10 things announced so far, and there'll be more stuff coming out for the end of the year. So it's slowly ramping up, even in the face of the COVID stuff. And once the production problems ease, they have a lot of stuff signed off on that's going to come out, you know, across 2021.
Yep. All right, let's do some Q&A stuff.
Jonas says, I don't like all the apps that require subscriptions. If every app I use has this model rather than one-time payment, it becomes expensive. I completely sympathize. Clearly, we are in a time of everything turning into some kind of subscription, and you can't afford it all. You can't pay for it all. There's just, if you took every single app that you used to have on your iPhone and then you start paying a subscription for every single one of them, it's just untenable. And I'm saying that as a developer who does actually have a subscription app of their own. But that's kind of the problem with the old model, is that it just became unsustainable, like for the developers to continue creating the applications and developing and maintaining them. The ongoing costs ramped up, and in the absence of like upgrade pricing or some alternative ideas, advertising wasn't cutting it. The subscription model is the most effective way to do it. And so as a customer, you basically have to pick and choose more selectively the apps that you want to support, and then look for free alternatives or paid alternatives or simpler alternatives for other stuff. And unfortunately, I don't see any reversal of that situation. You're not going to see like if everyone stopped buying subscription apps, you're not going to see people go back. You're just going to see people like slim down or trim what they pay for to like three or four applications or three or four services. Kind of like with TV, right? Like there are so many streaming services you can subscribe to, but you know, basically no one's going to subscribe to all of them. You're just going to subscribe to, you know, one, two, or three that you want to, and that doesn't mean the other ones are going to fade into irrelevance and disappear. Like they'll just carry on and serve their niches, and they'll have other people serving their audiences too. And as long as Apple has the monetary benefits of the fact that after the first year their commission gets halved, like they're incentivizing developers to adopt subscriptions for exactly that reason. Because if you can retain a customer for a year, you're basically making twice as much money than if you sold them, you know, version one of the app in the first year and version two of the app in the second year. So like, we're way down the rabbit hole there, and unfortunately it's never going to change. You just have to kind of pick and choose your four or five favorite apps that you want to support and then let everything else fall by the wayside.
Yeah. Another question is, could we see, instead of press releases, like just press releases, to have promo videos like for new products, like they had for the Magic Keyboard for the iPad? First, I had to think about that. Like, when did they do a video for a Magic Keyboard for the Mac? It's been a long time since they had a new update there, but it's the iPad version that they went video mode on. You know, sure, but that also made me think about just, you know, what will the fall events look like? Will there be one fall event? I guess so, you know, but if they do, you know, new products here and there, and not have a central event, that would be interesting.
I think it'll probably be like what we saw last year, except the fact that the iPhone event's going to be virtual, right? They're not going to have people come to a location. It's going to be filmed and pre-recorded just like WWDC. But last year they did the iPhone event with the watches, and then in October time they had the 16-inch MacBook Pro and they had the AirPods Pro come out just in like press releases and videos.
That's
so
true.
I think they're probably going to do that again, and next week we'll have press releases for, fingers crossed, the iPad Air. Then they'll follow up with an iPhone event, maybe having like the watches with it, and then maybe like AirTags or AirPods Studio. And then before the end of the year, they'll have like the Apple Silicon Mac unveiling and ship that as well. And that'll probably have like videos and stuff because it's, you know, significant. They might tease out the iPhone event actually. It'd be like, and we have our first Apple Silicon Mac shipping next month or something, just because it's such a big event for them, like a big deal, like this transition. But stuff like AirTags could just come out in October with like press releases and stuff. Like I think they showed last year they're more than happy to have a single event, but even if they've got spillover of products, they'll just do, you know, little mini press releases across October and November for them. Will you buy AirPods Studio? That's another question.
Yeah, I like the angle on that where when we did the HomePod review episode, where it was like HomePod is this brand new thing, and we spent a whole episode talking about just HomePod. And that was
in the climate, by the way, where most of the tech podcasts were just like laughing that HomePod is like a complete flop of a product. And fast forward a year, all those tech podcasts were like, we've got four of them, we love them. So I'll just say we were right from the beginning there.
Talk about anybody who was specific. for the AirPod Studio, I don't know. Like I'm not it's not so different that it's like AirPods, the first AirPods were so different that it's like we did an AirPods episode, didn't we?
Mm.
I'm not sure that we did one for pros.
No, we didn't do one for pros. We did one for the original AirPods. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure I'd feel that way about an AirPods Studio. I'll use them.
Yeah, you're gonna get them, right?
Well, it depends on the cost. If they're like $400, then probably not. It's not a priority.
True. Do you have over ear headphones at the moment?
Yeah.
What do you have at the moment? Beats Studios.
I sold Beats Studio because there's certainly on the way out. Beats Solo Pro, which my daughter uses them mostly, but there's a missing AirPods charging case, so they became useful in the last week or so, and they're really good. Like, you know, once you get over the fit of them compared to Studio, that, you know, the Studios are larger. The Solo Pros with transparency and with cancellation, they're really, really good.
Yeah,
I think that the folding it to turn it off is an awkward thing. I don't like that because I don't fold them otherwise, and it's just to turn them off now.
Yeah, and we can almost guarantee that the AirPods Studio are going to have just little sensors in the ear cups that will know when you take them off, so you won't have to worry about that.
Yeah, it's just, I think, right, I mean, this varies just kind of depending on what's going on in my life, but right now, on-ear or over-ear headphones are kind of secondary to just having a pair of AirPods that I haven't lost in a part two.
Yeah, baseline AirPods are very good. Like, I'm down for the AirPods Studio. I currently use, these are my only over-ear headphones that I have, and they are wireless, but they charge with, like, mini USB, so I never charge them. I just always plug them in. And these are like 5 years old now, and the ear cups are starting to get a bit dry, so I kind of need to change.
When I'm not missing, you know, half my recording equipment in a different state, then I use just any kind of, you know, earbud or earphone is my preference, you know, for listening to the audio from the podcast as we talk, have that live feedback. It's kind of like never preferred for me to have cups over my ears, and this lately, I don't know.
Yeah, like,
it's not, it changes, but not right now.
It's different. It's different opinions of different people, obviously. Like, I love my original AirPods, but I'm not keen on AirPod Pros. Like, I just don't.
If you have like serious headphones, I mean, and you love listening to music, it sounds way better.
Yeah.
You can also, I like to have like open music where I'm not having it on my head instead of this HomePod or, you know, my car stereo, like going for a drive and listening. That's like the best version of listening to something.
Yeah, like if I'm in my office, I just pick the HomePod to play music on the majority of the time.
All right, that is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. If you enjoy the show, you can listen every Thursday afternoon on YouTube at about 4 p.m. Eastern Time. I think that's 1 p.m. Pacific Time. If you like the audio, you can subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Overcast, on Spotify. And if you really enjoy the show, share it with a friend, leave a recommendation, leave a review. We really appreciate that. And if you ever want to come and join us for the live question and answer session at the end of each episode, that is on YouTube at youtube.com/95Mac. If you have any feedback, you can email us at happyhour@95Mac.com. I am Zach Hall. I'm on Twitter at ApolloZach. Benjamin Mayo, you're on Twitter at
BZAMayo.
All right. I will see you later, Benjamin Mayo.
Bye-bye.